Thank you for your kindness to us. Thank you for your word. Thank you for telling us the truth, not only about the world and about yourself, but also about ourselves. Sometimes it's not pleasant, but because you are true, we're able to accept even those things that are true about ourselves that are uncomfortable. And help us, Lord God, to be truly, help us to be better human beings. As followers of Messiah Yeshua, help us to be good representatives, good ambassadors that make people want to take notice that there is something different here and that there is somebody whose watchful eyes cause us to think a second time about the things we do and say. So we thank you for our study of Genesis tonight, and I pray that you'd help me to teach and help us all to learn. And we thank you in Yeshua's name. All right. So you're wondering, are we going to finish Genesis tonight? The answer is a resolute, I don't know. It could happen. We do live in an age of miracles. What we are going to pick up, though, at chapter 47... Verse 27. I know it's a little odd to leave off in the middle of a chapter, but those of you who've been coming to the Shema Bible study, and by the way, we welcome those of you who are listening online, you know that the method that we use here, at least on Wednesday nights, is it's not so much about a chapter, it's about a literary unit, or what would be called a pericope. Okay, I'm less interested in where the chapter number goes and more interested in where is it changing direction, where is the theme changing. And again, the chapter verses, the verse numbers, all of those things were added many, many, many centuries after the fact. So the fact that it says 48 is not part of the inspired record. Okay, so we're going to pick up at chapter 47, verse 27. Joseph has brought Jacob, his father, and the whole family to come settle in Egypt. And with Pharaoh's permission, they've settled in Land of Goshen, the best part of the land. And they kind of arranged that in a clever way. He said, look, when you guys come to Pharaoh and he asks you what you do for a living, tell him you're shepherds, which is actually true, but they might have done other things as well. But he says, just tell him you're shepherds, because the Egyptians can't stand shepherds, and that way he'll welcome the idea of you living in Goshen, which is in the burbs. Okay? So that was kind of an interesting way to make sure that that happened. So now we come to verse 27. And as we pick up, as I've been telling you, I want you to pay attention to the interplay between the names Jacob and Israel. Because his name is Jacob, but he's already had his name changed to Israel. But sometimes he's still being called Jacob, and sometimes Israel. And here you're going to see both of them, and you're also going to hear about Israel as the whole nation, which right now is 75 people. All right? Verse 27. Now Israel lived in the land of Egypt, in Goshen, and they acquired property in it and were fruitful and became very numerous. So there's an obvious reason why Moses, you know, through the inspiration of God's Spirit, wrote here, Israel lived in the land of Egypt, because it says they acquired property in it. They were fruitful and became very numerous. So it's obvious Israel, the nation. So Egypt is essentially going to act as an incubator of sorts. Our people went up, what, 70 to 70, or 75, if you count those already there, 75. And 400 years later, we're going to leave Egypt, a company of a little over 2 million. Yeah. All right. Verse 28, Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. Now, you remember what he said to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says to him, how old are you? Remember what Jacob does? He goes into his kvetch. He goes into the kvetch mode. For those of you who don't know, kvetch means to complain. He goes into his complaining mode. Ugh, few and miserable have been the years of my life. You should only know, right? I mean, you can just see it, right? Oy, Pharaoh, I wouldn't wish your worst enemy should have the life I've had. But the fact is, he was already 130 years of age. Few years? Of course, it's inverted hyperbole. And the fact is, many of those years were miserable because he was under the opinion that his son Joseph was dead, right? As far as he knew, his beloved Joseph had been ripped to shreds by some wild animal because his other sons brought back that bloodied, multicolored robe. And so he's had heartbreak in his life. And unfortunately, because he did play favorites, it really didn't matter to him apparently all that much that his other kids were still fine. You know, heartache is heartache, and it's real, and it takes time. But, I mean, he seems to genuinely have played favorites with Joseph and Benjamin because they were the sons of Rachel, who he loved more than Leah. So I suppose you could say some of the misery of those few miserable years was to an extent his own doing. All right, but I'm not here to opine on that. Okay, so verse 29. This is where things get very important. When the time came for Israel to die, drew near, he called his son Joseph. Okay, so now suddenly he's called Israel again. He was called Jacob in the previous two verses because to distinguish him from Israel, the nation. But now it's back to calling him Israel. When the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "Please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt. But when I die, but when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place." And he said, "I will do as you have said." And he said, "Swear to me." So he swore to him. Then Israel bowed in worship at the head of the bed. Interesting. It doesn't so much dawn on us moderns the issue of where we die and are buried. I mean, for the last several generations here in America and in the West in general, people have moved around quite a bit. I mean, it's nothing for somebody who grew up in Boston to relocate to Phoenix for their career. It's nothing for somebody from Atlanta to come up here to Michigan, to Detroit, you know, for career, what have you. We don't really think that much of it. You hope that your kids will find their careers, you know, close enough to home that you can see them when you want to see them. My mother and father-in-law were very happy when I moved Alexandra and me back here to Michigan. We had been in New York and New Jersey. I really ingratiated myself with my in-laws by moving us back. But the fact is that in the ancient world, the idea of being buried, dying, being buried and gathered to your family, as it were, to your people, was very important. People didn't just up and leave to start a career somewhere else if there was any other way. The idea that people lived where they lived, they died where they were raised, they raised their family where they were raised, they were buried where they were raised, and the euphemism is were gathered to their people. And this makes all the more precious what Ruth said to Naomi when Naomi said, you know, why don't you go back to Moab, to your people? And what did Ruth say? No way. Where you go, I will go. Where you live, I will live. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, there I will die, and there I will be buried. That's huge. It's huge in the ancient world. So for another example, when God calls Abraham at age 75 to up and leave his father and his family, who had made it as far as Haran, but God was calling him to Canaan, and to leave everything. Abraham's 75 years old. He's departing for parts unknown. And that's huge in the ancient world. It shows the level of Ruth's devotion. It shows the level of Abraham's faith to do these sorts of things. So Jacob, he knows his days are coming to an end. He asks Joseph to come to him, and the idea is put his hand under the thigh. The thigh, right, the loins, as it were, right, were considered the strength of a man. Right? So in a sense, you're swearing by the strength of the man, and you're also swearing by the generations that have proceeded from the loins of that man. That's the idea here. Put your hand under my thigh and take an oath. Don't bury me in Egypt. I want to be buried with our people, Abraham and Isaac, my father, right? Bury me in the land of our fathers. So he's got his hand under his thigh. He says, I will do it. I will do as you have said. But again, verse 31, he said, swear to me. So he swore to him, made an oath. So here's a question for you. Would Joseph have done it if he hadn't had to swear the oath, if he'd have just said, I'll do that for you? I think he'd have done it, because Joseph is a godly man. He's a man who does what he says. He's a man who understands he's under the gaze of God. Jacob and Joseph, you know, they say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But this is one of those cases where I think Joseph was really an exceptional person. And really exceeded his father for godliness and for humility and for wisdom. Sometimes that happens. I think this is one of those times. Now, why do I bring that up? What did those of you who are literate in New Testament, what did Jesus say about taking oaths?
Don't do it.
He said, don't do it. He said, don't say, well, I swear by the temple, or I swear by heaven, or I swear by the angels. By the way, the Greek word in the New Testament for a promise or an oath is epangelion, upon the angels. When people made an oath in the ancient world, they always swore upon something or someone greater than themselves, which leads me to think that even the Greek of the New Testament was influenced by Jewish theology and Jewish thought. But Yeshua said, don't make any oath. You don't even have the power to turn one hair white or black. I sometimes wish I did, especially these on my face. Okay, but anyway, he said, make no oath. Just let your yes be yes, and let your no be no. In other words, if you fear God and you call yourself a follower of Yeshua and you say you're going to do something, there should just be no question that's what's going to happen. So there are people that you know that they tell you they're going to do the thing. You don't have to give it a second thought, right? Then there are some people who you have to have them sign 26 pages of legal documentation, and you're still not really sure they're going to follow through. We need to be the former kind of person. To the extent that we are people who are good to our word, we glorify God and we bring honor to the name of Yeshua. To the extent that we violate our word, we diminish people's view of the one we serve. So we're responsible, in a sense, for fostering either very good feelings that people have about who God is, or resentment about who he is, to the extent that we do right by them or do wrong by them. Pretty weighty responsibility, but nobody ever said being a disciple was supposed to be easy. But remember what Yeshua said after that? He said, make no oath. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. And then he said, let's see if you guys can finish this. Beyond anything beyond this is of the evil one. Now, again, usually when people swear they're going to do something, they do it because they know that you don't have confidence in them. Okay, here's what just came to mind. Remember, okay, have most of you seen the movie The Princess Bride? I love that movie, okay? And there's this great sword fight, right? There's this great duel between Mandy Patinkin plays the sword. Inigo Montoya. Inigo Montoya, thank you. My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die, right? Inigo and Wesley, who he thinks is the Dread Pirate Roberts. And if you have not seen The Princess Bride, it's worth seeing the whole movie just for that scene. Okay? He's climbing up a rope to get to the top because it's the cliffs of despair and it's 5,000 feet down or whatever. And he's climbing up. And the guy at the top, Inigo Montoya, is waiting up there to kill him. And he says, could you hurry up already? He goes, well, you're not helping. I mean, you want to throw me a rope or something? Or, you know, he says, besides, I know you're waiting there to kill me when I get up there. He says, I promise you that I won't kill you until you've had a chance to rest and then we'll have a proper fight. He says, I forget if he asks if he's a Spaniard. He says, forget that. He says, I swear to you by my father, Diego Montoya, you will reach the top alive. He says, throw the rope. So when somebody swears an oath, when they swear to something, they're like trying to guarantee because they know that you are not confident that they're going to follow through. If you're the kind of person who does follow through, in other words, you're truly a disciple, no oath is necessary. You say you're going to do it, do it. So there's that admonition. I'm convinced Joseph would have done it, even without the oath. But there it is. Jacob wants an oath. Remember, what do we know about Jacob? He's a trickster who's also been tricked by his father-in-law. And he's assuming that Joseph might play the trickster. But he doesn't know his son. His son and he have been separated for all these years. Joseph has gone through the crucible of being betrayed and sold by his brothers, of being falsely accused, of being thrown in a prison, of being forgotten there. I mean, all of those things are either going to destroy a person or they're going to create proven character in them. And in Joseph's case, it really made him a godly, humble man. So, all right, so he swears the oath. Now we come to chapter 48. Now it came about after these things that Joseph was told, behold, your father is sick. It was 147, I mean, right? So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him. And I think he brought his sons because he understood, my father is coming to the end now, and my sons need to be here for this. So he takes Manasseh and Ephraim with him. When it was told to Jacob, behold, your son Joseph has come to you, Israel collected his strength and sat up in the bed. Again, right there in the one verse, he's called Jacob and he's called Israel. Israel collected his strength and sat up in the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. Now, do you remember what Luz had the name changed to? Bethel, the house of God. And he said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous, and I will make you a company of peoples, and will give this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. Just reiterating the covenant, the promise made to Abraham. The promise was continued to Isaac, not Ishmael. The promise was then continued to Jacob, not Esau. But the point is, it's the one and the same promise. I'm giving you this land in perpetuity. Verse 5, now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine as Reuben and Shimon are. Okay? Interesting. And I wonder if Joseph sort of half anticipated this, right? That Jacob was going to do this. He's claiming Manasseh and Ephraim as his sons, which is why in Israel, there was a tribe of Manasseh and the tribe of Ephraim, not a tribe of Joseph. Okay. Verse 6, but your offspring that have been born after them shall be yours. You're thinking, gee, thanks, Dad. Glad to know I get to have my kids. Right? They shall be called by the names of their brothers in their inheritance. Now, as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died to my sorrow in the land of Canaan on the journey when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And of course, that's the same Bethlehem, Ephrath, from which we get the prophecy in Micah that a ruler will emerge, will rise up for Israel, whose goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. But that prophecy begins, but you, Bethlehem Ephrath, little among the clans of Judah, right? Pitskala, little town. One stoplight, and it's a blinking red, okay? It's just little podunk town. Yet this little town of Bethlehem would become so important to all of world history because that's where the Messiah is going to be born. Well, that's where Rachel had been buried. And her tomb is one of the holiest sites in Judaism to this day. But Bethlehem is not under Jewish jurisdiction. It's under Islamic jurisdiction. Palestinians are basically running the show there. I couldn't even get into Bethlehem safely. I'd have to be ushered in with a group or with some dignitary who could explain why this Jew needed to be there. It's terrible. All right, verse 8. When Israel, notice now he's Israel, when Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, who are these? Joseph said to his father, they are my sons whom God has given me here. So he said, bring them to me, please, that I may bless them. Now the eyes of Israel were so dim from age that he could not see. Then Joseph brought them close to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your children as well. That is so beautiful. And now I want to take it another step again. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, and then it's Israel, it says, now Israel said to Joseph, verse 11, Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see your face. And behold, God has let me see your children as well. If Joseph is a type of the Messiah, and he is, Israel never expected to see Yeshua's face again. But he will. And his sons and daughters. Verse 12. Then Joseph took them from his knees and bowed with his face to the ground. Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right, because Manasseh is the firstborn. So he's assuming his father Jacob is going to pronounce a blessing, in which case the firstborn of the two of them should have the preeminence. So he makes sure that Manasseh is over here on Jacob, on Israel's right, and Ephraim is on the left. And what does Israel do? Verse 14, but Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, crossing his hands, although Manasseh was the firstborn. He blessed Joseph and said, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil. Whoa, stop. This is a threefold pronouncement. Do you see this? The God who has done this, the God who has been this, the angel who has done this. This is a very significant. Those of you who have been in Bible study here, you know that when you have a threefold affirmation of some kind, it's extremely significant, right? Both in the Hebrew language and within Judaism. So, for example, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Adonai Eloheinu Adonai. Psalm 118. The right hand of the Lord has done mighty things. The right hand of the Lord is lifted high. The right hand of the Lord has done mighty things. It's not arbitrary repetition. It's not redundancy. It's a threefold affirmation. Aren't you one of his disciples? I don't know that man. A few minutes later, I could have sworn I saw you with him. You're one of his disciples. I tell you, I don't know him. I don't know what you're talking about. And then a third time, a short time later, you were with him. I saw you with him. And then he swears, I don't know the man. Peter's threefold denial of Yeshua. What happens after Yeshua's resurrection? They have a little breakfast by the Sea of Galilee, and then Yeshua and Peter are taking a little walk, and Yeshua says, Simon Barjona, do you love me more than these? He says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Simon, son of John, and then he says, tend my sheep. Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Feed my sheep. Simon, son of John, or Simon Barjona, do you love me more than these? And he's grieved that he's asked him now a third time. Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. You know all things. He says, feed my sheep. Now you'll hear, and it's true, you'll hear a lot of pastors say the reason that Peter was so sad the third time around is because Yeshua had been saying, do you agape me? Do you love me with a pure, unselfish love? And he answered, Lord, you know that I phileo you. I love you like a brother. Simon, son of John, do you agape me? Yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you. Not quite rising to that. And then the third time Yeshua says, Simon, do you phileo me? So they'll say he's sad because Yeshua isn't even sure that he has that. But there's truth in that. But the fact is, Peter was being reminded by being asked three times that three times he had renounced him. In the ancient world, and maybe it's still true in the Orthodox world, and if anybody knows, let me know. How do you divorce? You say three times, I divorce thee, I divorce thee, I divorce thee. The third time seals the deal. So when you have something three times, this is a long, forgive me, way of just saying when you have a threefold affirmation of some kind. It's significant. Okay, the words of Genesis were chosen by God, given through the Holy Spirit. And so again, when Jacob is blessing, about to bless Ephraim and Manasseh, first, what does he say to Joseph? The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Angels don't bless. You have God, God, and the angel. I submit to you that the angel is Messiah. Angels don't have the authority to bless. All right. Bless the lads, and may my name live on in them, and the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. He's praying, but you see how he's also prophesying? Because these things were going to happen, right? These things actually happened. Jacob is also a prophet. Verse 17, when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him, and he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also will become a people, and he also will be great. However, his younger brother, Ephraim, doesn't say that, but his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. When you read about, for example, in the book of Isaiah, when God is chastising the northern kingdom of Israel for their sin, this is during the divided monarchy, as often as not, he calls Israel Ephraim. Because the tribe of Ephraim became very numerous and great, and the northern kingdom of Israel was nicknamed Ephraim. And Ephraim did end up having more preeminence. Remember, Manasseh was one of the tribes that wanted to settle east of the Jordan. Remember? You had Reuben, Gad, and half-tribe of Manasseh east of the Jordan River. So Manasseh never quite attained to nearly the prominence of Ephraim. You had a question? Oh, okay. All right. Let's go on. So Jacob says, look, I know what I'm doing here. You know, I know what I'm doing here. The younger shall have more preeminence than the older. Verse 20, he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will pronounce blessings, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Now, I know we have a number of you here on a Wednesday evening who don't necessarily come on Saturday mornings. That's fine, by the way. It's great. No problem. But what you will see if you've never been here on a Saturday morning is before we send the kids off to their Shabbat school classes, we bring them up front with the parents and ask God's blessings on them. And from time to time, Rabbi Lauren will say, sons, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh, the blessed and numerous and fruitful tribes in Israel. So this word of Jacob is being observed to this day. Verse 21, then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I am about to die, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. I give you one portion more than your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. That verse is troublesome for some scholars because they haven't really encountered the Amorite yet. But again, Jacob is a prophet. I believe he's speaking prophetically. Israel will encounter the Amorites. And yes, Joseph will come back to the land of his fathers, but not while he's alive. Because just as Jacob didn't want to be buried in Egypt, Joseph made the Jewish people swear that after his death, they would take his bones with them whenever that generation would return to the land of Canaan. And they did. All right. Let's see here. Let's continue on a little bit. Shall we go right into chapter 49? A little daring, because there's so much here. We are not going to get through chapter 49. I think we're only going to get through verse 12, if that. So now Jacob is dying. He summoned his sons, chapter 49, verse 1. Jacob summoned his sons and said, "Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come." See, I didn't make this thing up that Jacob was a prophet. I didn't pull that out of a hat. It's not a matter of my opinion. He's going to tell them what's going to happen in the future. He's a prophet, and he knows it. Verse 2, "Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father." You notice the formality here. This isn't just like, hey, let's get together and have a little lunch. You know, my time's at hand, you know. No, this is a very formal event. The passing of the torch, if you will, the handing off of the mantle, the placing of authority, and giving tribal leadership to one of those sons. Who's it going to be? Well, normally it's the firstborn, right? And that would be Reuven. Watch what happens here. Verse 2, "Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father, Reuven. You are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power." And you can just picture Reuven going, "Yeah, here it comes, baby. Come on, Dad. I'm ready. Give me that, you know. I'm going to be the one, right? Yeah. I'm going to be the preeminent in dignity. That's me, preeminent in power." Verse 4. "Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." And I can just imagine Jacob thinking, "Oh, did you think I forgot about that, Reuven?" Reuven was the firstborn, but what he did disqualified him to be the next head of the family of Israel. He forfeited it. All right, next up, Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi are brothers. "Their swords are implements of violence. Let not my soul enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." And that prophecy came to pass. So Shimon and Levi, what is he talking about? Slaying men, hamstringing oxen. What's he talking about? This goes back, I believe, to chapter 34, where their sister Dinah had been raped by Shechem, son of Hamor, when she went into the town of Shechem to visit the daughters there and see what life was like, and he raped her. And then he wanted to marry her. And so he said, and his dad was Hamor, the king of Shechem. He says, "Dad, get me her for a wife. I want her for a wife." So Hamor goes to Jacob and says, "My son loves your daughter. He wants to marry her. Why don't we do this? Why don't we join our peoples together? We'll give you our daughters in marriage. You give us your sons in marriage. We'll become one bigger people." Because he's thinking, you know, this guy's wealthy. Why not like the Borg, assimilate him into Shechem. Well, Shimon and Levi, all the brothers find out that this guy's son had raped their sister, and they're furious. Shimon and Levi say, well, you know, we can't just intermarry with you guys. See, our God has given us a covenant where all of our men have to be circumcised in their foreskin. And your men aren't circumcised. So we couldn't intermarry with you under those circumstances. And he's the king, and his spoiled, rotten, brat son wants to marry this girl, so he's going to have all the men of Shechem circumcised so his son can marry this guy's daughter. And it goes without saying, they didn't exactly have general anesthesia. So what happened? After all the men had had their foreskins cut off, they're all writhing in pain, right? On the second or third day, Shimon and Levi go into the town of Shechem, and while all the men are laid out and helpless, they slaughter every one of them. Slaughtered every one of them. Jacob is forced to leave that area, take the whole family and leave that area. Of course, God didn't want him settling in Shechem. God wanted him in Canaan, and he didn't want Israel marrying into polytheistic, right, culture. So they moved on. But the point is, Shimon and Levi were unfit. Neither of them were fit to be the next leader in Israel. And now, in terms of Levi, the tribe of Levi, when Moses came down off the mountain in the day of the golden calf debacle, remember Israel had built a golden calf, Moses comes down off the mountain, there's a glorified orgy going on down there, and people are just running riot, and they're bowing down to this golden calf and offering sacrifices. And you know this story. Moses is livid about this. And he essentially drew a line in the sand of the Sinai and said, whoever is for Adonai, come to me. Now, there were 12 tribes in Israel. Only one rallied to him, the tribe of Levi. And he said, you need to put to death the leaders of this rebellion. And so the men of the tribe of Levi actually had to put 3,000 men to death for leading this rebellion. And they were blessed by God for rallying to Moses and standing up for the holiness of God. And so Levi became the tribe given the singular privilege of having jurisdiction over the tabernacle and later the temple. But you know what's interesting? They didn't have their own land. All the other tribes were given an allotment of land, right? Gad and Benjamin, Judah, Issachar, all of them are given their own once we came into the land. But Levi, the tribe of Levi, was given no land. What does God say? I'm their portion. That doesn't mean they were homeless. God provided for them, right? They had, you know, lands reserved for them, but they didn't have tribal ownership of any land. So even in this, Jacob's prophecy comes to pass. I will disperse them in Jacob. And that's exactly what happened. If you were a Levite, you know, you're not living, there's no tribal land called the Levi where they're all living together. You had Levites up there and Levites over there and Levites down yonder and Levites over here because the people needed the Levites, right, to help because they served as judges also to settle disputes and to lead the religious life of Israel until such time as the temple was built. So even in this, his prophecy is fulfilled. So Reuben, Shimon, Levi, And now we come to son number four. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches. He lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who dares rouse him up? So Judah is being compared to the king of the beasts, right? The most powerful regal of all the animals, the lion. So it comes to Judah. You know, if Judah had done something to forfeit it, you realize we wouldn't be called Jews today. We might be called Naphtalim or Gadites or Issacharites. But the fact is we're called Jews because Judah, Yehuda, from which we get Yehudi, was the one who was given the preeminence. He's compared to a lion. And now we have a prophecy in verse 10 that relates to Messiah. The scepter. You know what a scepter is, right? King holds that glorified pole, but it represents his authority, right? The king holds that scepter. It's usually got something fancy and ornate with jewels up here, right? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until the one comes to whom it is. Now notice that's different from every one of your translations, right? Many of your translations reads, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes. How many have Shiloh? Let me show me your hands if your Bible that you are reading says Shiloh. Okay. How many of you have something else? And what does yours say? Until he comes to whom it belongs? Until he comes to whom it belongs. That's the Shiloh has become a name of a place, but also a name for Messiah. But understand what's going on here. And now, forgive me, and don't stay with me, because I'm going to give you a little bit of Hebrew grammar here. But stay with me, it's important. And where we're going with this is very important, and I'm going to close with it for tonight. Shiloh actually should be understood as Shiloh. She is the a particle of speech. It's a prefix to a word. It's a direct, not directive object. It has to do with the object. It's the object marker. She means with reference to. Okay, Avinu Sheba Shamayim, our Father, which is in heaven. Sheba, meaning having reference to or with regard to. Our Father, Sheba Shamayim, not my earthly dad. Avinu Sheba Shamayim, our Father, with reference to the one in heaven. Shelo, She being the particle of speech, meaning referencing the object. And Lo, the Lamed, is a directive prefix, meaning to or towards. It can also mean for, but generally to or towards. And then the O at the end, the holam at the end, or holam vav if it's in that form, is a third person masculine singular possessive. His. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until he comes whose it is. In other words, there was going to come a point in time when Judah would be handing off the scepter to the one to whom it belongs ultimately. That's Messiah. That's Messiah. Why am I going into all this detail? Because, for example, as you read the Gospel of John, you keep reading about the Jews did this, and the Jews sent priests and Levites to do this, and the Jews answered him and said this, if the term Jews was being used the way we use the term today, it would make no sense because everybody in the story is Jewish. What was the Jews sent him priests? What else would they be? Norwegian? Right? Unfortunately, the history here has been lost. But when it says, for example, that the Jews of Jerusalem sent priests and Levites to ask John the Baptist who he was, Jews should be understood as Judeans, because everybody's Jewish, the way we use the word Jews. Everybody there is Jewish. They should be understood as Judeans. In other words, Judah, the Yehudim, were still holding that scepter. They're still ruling in Israel at the time when Yeshua comes. They wield that scepter. And if you want to understand in a shorthand way the whole conflict between Messiah Yeshua and the Jewish religious leaders, I wish they would translate it Judeans, but it's translated Jews, so people think it's anti-Semitic. It isn't. It was written by Jews. But the whole nature of this conflict is that Shiloh, if you will, or Shiloh, the one to whom that scepter is, right, has come. And the Judeans are not willing to hand off that scepter. That is the short, that's the thumbnail understanding of that conflict between Yeshua and the Jewish religious leaders. Shiloh, the one to whom that scepter should be handed, has come, and Judah is saying, we are not handing this off. That's the long and the short of it. And the rest of it is looking for excuses to justify a decision they already made. But now let me bring this full circle. At the very beginning of our study, even before we launched into Genesis tonight, I talked to you about human nature. One of the unfortunate, sad realities of fallen human nature is our lust for power. Finish this statement with me. Power corrupts, and absolute power... Yeah. That saying is there for a reason, because it's true. Power to fallen human nature is like an aphrodisiac. People acquire power, and they'll do anything to hold on to it. Messiah came, Shiloh, the one to whom it is, and the Yehudim, the Jewish religious leaders, the Judeans, did not want to hand off that scepter. Genesis chapter 49, verse 10 is a very, very important messianic prophecy. I really recommend that you commit that one to memory and be able to explain it to others as well. Because understanding it not only helps you understand the conflict between Messiah and the Jewish leaders of his generation, but it also will help you to finally put to silence this false accusation that the New Testament is anti-Semitic. It isn't. But because people don't make the distinction between Judeans, those of the tribe of Judah that had leadership, and Jews, people assume the worst. So rightly understanding this helps us in a lot of ways. All right, let's pray. Lord God, thank you for our time together. Thank you for this word. Thank you for putting it in Jacob's mind and heart, the things to say to Joseph, the things to say about Ephraim and Manasseh, the things to prophesy about his sons, the progenitors of the tribes of Israel. Thank you for this promise about the one to whom that scepter belongs, the true lion of the tribe of Judah. We thank you for Messiah Yeshua. Thank you for our time in the Word tonight. I pray that you please give everybody safe travels home, and we thank you for your kindness. And before I forget, Lord God, we together want to ask your choicest blessings on our brothers and sisters here at Bloomfield Hills Baptist for their kindness to us. please pour out a real blessing upon them as well. And we thank you in Yeshua's name.